Hello, and welcome to the Let's Talk Transformation podcasts. Today, we will be exploring the subject of empathy and its place in creating leadership and cultures where people can thrive. I'm delighted to welcome Neil Frick, co-author of The E-Suite, Empathetic Leadership for the Next Generation of Executives. Neil, welcome to the show.
Susie, thank you so much for having me. I really appreciate it.
It's a pleasure to have you on the show. Neil, I know you love sci-fi and I know you like technology. In fact, that's where you spend most of your time. But I know you're also passionate about bringing more understanding, particularly to the C-suite, understanding of empathy and what that can bring in terms of a different type of leadership, hence the title. So can you tell us more about that quest, Neil? Why did you write the E-suite and why now?
Certainly. Well, you know, during COVID, I think a lot of people's perceptions of work-life balance really shifted and in a positive way. You know, it really highlighted organizations that do people-first leadership, empathetic leadership, right? I think a lot of people, historically, traditional leaders have thought of empathy as sort of a soft skill, a weak skill. And I have seen an incredible return on investment and actual metrics-based improvements to organizations from revenue through customer engagement, through profitability, by simply applying an empathetic leadership approach.
And I like, so you mix the words, you know, soft and weak when we talk about empathy. And I think that is the myths we're up against in a lot of organizations and organizational culture around empathy is about, you know, being vulnerable, and being vulnerable is not strong leadership in inverted commas. And I like the fact also that you're talking about case studies of what works and what doesn't and how it can have impact. We'll come back to that in your book that I really like about the canvases and the different operational things there are in there. But I also like the fact that your book touches on the different areas of organizational strength, leadership, and then the impact on the business and therefore transformation. Can you walk our listeners through how those levels fit together for you? It's very obvious when you read the book, of course, but it's interesting from a holistic level of how they come together.
Yeah, absolutely. So you specifically mean different organizations kind of within, or how, I guess, the organization's approach to leadership at different levels within the org. So I think the overall structure of an organization, obviously most are very hierarchical and kind of people lead from the top. I think it's incredibly important for executive leaders to apply empathy and openness when they are setting kind of the standard for their culture. But what we did in the book was break it down by functional areas. So for example, you know, marketing and branding, if you are interacting with a customer and you know more about them because you understand their emotional state, you understand the challenges that they're going through, you are more able to market your product appropriately. And I always harken back to, if you think about adverts that have impacted you the most, they tend to be the ones that struck some kind of emotional chord or solved a problem that you have directly. And empathy is really about context. It's about understanding a person's emotional state, how they're feeling, what they're thinking, what they're doing, what they need, and then making decisions based on that context. It's not about sympathy or niceness. And I think that's why there is that perception of sort of the weak skill, if you will.
It's about reframing, isn't it? I mean, you talk in your book around sales and, you know, reframing it and looking at it as relationship building, using empathy, which then becomes a superpower, as opposed to cold calling and just, you know, numbers of calls and numbers of leads. But you also talk about business empathy. Can you tell us a little bit more about business empathy? I mean, we touched on marketing there, but I found that concept really interesting.
Yeah, I think there is a difference between kind of common empathy and then business-focused empathy. And it really is about, because businesses are all about people, it's about understanding the person that you are working with, that you are engaging with, and then making decisions in context. It's a tool in your belt. It shouldn't be driving your result necessarily, but it is a tool that you would leverage. And an example I will use, you know, a lot lately is if you think of like a tree with a diseased branch, right? A person who's applying business empathy would look at the branch, understand that it is in trouble, but also understand the potential impact of it on the tree as a whole, and then make a strategic decision. Do we cut the branch off? Do we renew? You know, I don't know about, not a lot about gardening, so that's where my analogy falls apart. But the idea being, then now that you have the context of what's going on, how do you make the most strategically impactful decision for your business? It's not about saying, saying, oh, this person's going through a really hard time, therefore we let them off the hook. Mm. It's about, oh, this person's going through a really hard time. Is there flexibility that we can offer so that their productivity doesn't suffer? Is there a way to salvage this experience? Is there a way fairly to provide an adjustment that allows them to continue to work, not at the detriment of the business or of the team? Because mm. that's where that perception comes from, is this idea that empathy is sympathy. And so if somebody's parent passed away, then, you know, well, we just will let them not work on anything difficult for 6 months. But the rest of the team is all have their own lives that they're going through and challenges. So really, business empathy is using empathy as a tool, but not letting it make decisions for you.
Mm. And I really like the idea of actually deliberately and intentionally using empathy as a leadership skill, but also as a leadership lever. And if I look at, you know, the four building blocks I think of an inclusive environment, start with empathy. So you have empathy, psychological safety, co-responsibility, and then collective vision. And you talk about collective vision and you pick it up in empathetic confrontation. Can you tell us a little bit more about empathetic confrontation and how it's linked to collective vision and therefore organizational transformation?
Yeah, I think, you know, when you think about the confrontations that you've had to either lead or been a part of, the ones that have had the most impact and have safeguarded the most people really come from a place of, honestly, it's sort of your four tenets. It's making sure that it's a safe environment. It's making sure that you understand the context. So mm. not only what happened, but why did it happen? Mm. Because in a lot of cases with confrontation, there is a lot of reaction to the situation. Yeah. Someone did X and therefore the punishment is Y. The remediation is Y. Mm. And I get that. It's very easy to be reactive as a leader. But when you understand the motivation of the individual, when you understand the context and the emotional state of all parties involved, you can structure confrontation that is non-combative. It's not even really confrontational as much as it is people working together to solve a common problem. Mm. How do we avoid these issues that made this person feel like this or that made this situation result in this negative activity? That is really an open conversation with all parties involved to solve a problem. And that's much more kind of an empathetic approach than your standard, well, you did this or you failed here, so therefore this is the remediation, without any of that kind of two-way dialogue.
Mm, because you're essentially creating unity, aren't you? But not necessarily homogenous views.
Yes, exactly. Yeah, mm. you're creating that level of trust. The most devastating, but also the most advancing confrontations that I've had to deal with or have been ones where the person, you know, we had this really intense conversation, but I felt safeguarded and listened to and mm. trusted. And then, you know, we were able to come to a solution together. And sometimes that solution is, okay, this isn't working. Someone needs to move on, or mm. this behavior needs to change. It doesn't mean allowing bad behavior. It simply means kind of collectively building that vision together and then executing it.
Mm. And I love the idea that it's okay to disagree. So psychological safety isn't about being nice, is it? It's about creating a space where you can have healthy challenge or empathetic confrontation. And I don't see enough of that happening. I don't experience that enough. And I think the higher you go in organizations, the less you feel that, because you might hear it. So I'm careful with my words here. I think the less you feel that. It's interesting for me to understand what your definition would be of senior leaders creating these conditions for empathetic confrontation. What I love about your book is it's very hands-on. You know, you've got your key takeaways and your canvases, and there's lots of case studies and real examples in there. So could you walk us through a couple of examples of what it would look like, Neil, if the leaders were creating the conditions for this to happen?
Certainly, absolutely. I'll give you two examples, both personal, you know, one where I made a good choice and one where I made a bad choice when applying empathetic leadership. So I write a lot. Obviously, I wrote the book, but I also have a Medium blog. And I wrote about quite extensively about my own personal struggles with imposter syndrome, with mental health challenges. I'm very open about kind of the experiences that I go through just as a person. And I have no problem with people approaching me and talking to me about it. And it led to a conversation with one of my employees around mental health challenges that they were having, that they were afraid to bring to the forefront because they were afraid it was going to make them look weak or incapable. Mm. Then we were able to structure something in which they were able to be more successful, because what they really needed at the end of the day was more flexibility. So when I talk about executive leaders opening up that conversation, I mean, they have to lean. They have to start at the top and say, hey, this is what I'm going through. This is transparently what is going on. And you are in a safe space and can come and talk to me. That is incredibly important. That is that psychological safety, because there's such a stigma around these challenges. And I think it's imperative for leaders to open that conversation and not wait for people to come to you. And then, you know, when I was kind of a middle manager actually my background was in talent acquisition, and only within the last maybe 5 or 6 years have I been in executive leadership roles. I had an employee who was a high performer, but was affecting the morale on the team because of some bad behavior. Mm-hmm. He was going through some personal stuff, and I allowed the behavior to go on for way too long. And that was a true misapplication of empathy. I understood the context, but what I did with it was I was too nice. I was too sympathetic. And what I've learned from that is, you know, I lost trust with the rest of my team as a result of that. And what I do now is, okay, you're going through something tough, but this behavior is happening and here's how it's impacting people. It doesn't matter. This is the conversation. Here are the steps that we need to take to fix it. And I'm going to help you as much as possible. But at the end of the day, the whole organism of the business has to be in sync and has to be healthy. And you can't let one person or one group of people really impact it. So that's what, you know, the book kind of outlines is at every kind of step within your leadership, what can you do on a day-to-day basis to kind of foster that empathetic approach?
It's the personal agency, isn't it, that we all have in any system. Here we're talking about the workplace, to actually leverage situations and have what I call courageous conversations, which is exactly what you're talking about, which are also difficult and will always remain difficult because, you know, emotions are hard. But it also brings me to communication. You know, an effective communication. I think, you know, a lot of people are listening to reply because we're so busy as opposed to listening to understand. And communication gets lost. And you dedicate a whole chapter and more to this. But the case study of Jose and Alicia really sticks in my mind, where you take us through an example, a little bit like that, you know, a real life example. And, you know, you give lots of tips and tricks. And there are 7 steps in your book linked to effective communication that I found very helpful. Could you walk us through those 7 steps, and how can we ensure that we're doing what you propose or having the impact that we would like to have?
Yeah, absolutely. So I will say my co-author and I wrote this back during COVID, and I have noticed as I've been kind of going through this process with folks that my recollection of details do seem to be a little bit challenged. But so I think the first thing is, whenever you're kind of, are you talking about the from an empathetic confrontation standpoint, those 7 steps?
Yeah.
Okay. So I think the first thing is to really identify sort of why you're meeting with a person, right? You know, you have to come to kind of a common goal together, resolving an issue, whether it be an interpersonal conflict or, you know, someone who is not performing, you know, they need to understand prior to this meeting that what's going on, what the outcome is, you know, likely to be, you know, hey, we really want to get this fixed, but here are the steps that we need to take. You know, the worst thing that you can do is surprise someone with a confrontation, because then emotions get so much more involved. I think the second part of that is not to let your own emotional state get kind of wrapped up, right? Don't make a play for the other person's emotions and try to get them on your side sympathetically, or make them see it from your perspective. Instead, really identify what the issue is with that individual and be focused on their emotional state. And then monitor your reactions, right? It's very easy to get angry. It's very easy to react to a situation. But if you are well prepared and you feel that you are in the right, then, you know, you should be able to maintain as much of a calm demeanor as possible. One step in there is basically allow the other person some grace. Don't put them in a situation where they're going to be embarrassed. Don't confront people in front of others. And then tying it back to kind of that empathetic contextual understanding, look for the underlying issue and not the behavior. You know, if someone's acting out, they're not acting out because they want to be acting out. They're acting out because they've got something going on that is triggering them in some way. So focus on, hey, what do you need for this to no longer be the problem? Come up with constructive ways to solve the problem, right? Have an idea when you're going into it of what you would like the resolution to be. For instance, in that situation with the individual that I mismanaged and, you know, did not counsel enough, I should have gone in and said, hey, look, your performance is fantastic. You know, it's the compliment sandwich, right? Your performance is fantastic. You're doing a wonderful job. Your behavior is really impacting the team, but we want to make this work. We value you as an employee. How can we get to the root of what is causing this interpersonal conflict? And then come up with solutions. Hey, does it make sense? You're kind of an individual contributor. Does it make sense for you to maybe work remote more? Is there a personality conflict? Do you need to be physically in a different location than the people that you're working with? Do we need to have team building, you know, opportunities? Come up with solutions that will really kind of push the situation forward rather than focusing on the negative. And I think I missed a step there, but I got 6 out of 7. So I'm pretty happy about it.
and as we move on from COVID, let's just say we're now post-pandemic and things have changed. And there is a lot more discussion around this type of topic, empathy, empathetic leadership, conscious leadership, authentic leadership. The fact that people need to adopt a different style of leadership to engage their people differently, particularly in a more interconnected world. If I look at organizational design, it's moving towards more concentric circles as opposed to pyramids, although the mindset is probably still in a pyramid structure in terms of, you know, hierarchy and how leadership has been done and is done. Are you seeing that shift, Neil, at all? Are you seeing a shift in leadership at the sort of higher levels of organizations, not just in your own organization, but, you know, with your networks of peers and things like that, since you wrote the book?
I wish I could say yes.
I wanted you to say yes.
And I want to say yes. And in some cases, yes. What I have seen instead is a big shift from the workforce, an idea that empathetic leadership and working in a safe and collaborative and positive environment is very important. And then I'm seeing a lot of pushback from some senior leaders around what that looks like, right? This idea of having to return to the workplace 5 days a week, which makes it very difficult for single parents, which makes it very difficult for people who have non-traditional family situations. This idea that we need to go back to the way that things were pre-COVID kind of flies in the face of that empathetic leadership. I have seen people certainly be more open, and there are a lot of companies out there that are doing it phenomenally, but there are also a lot of generational differences where I found that older generations tend to have a very structured and rigid perspective of what makes a workplace successful. And those entering the workforce feel very differently. And so there's a lot of intergenerational conflict in the workplace right now that I think is causing strife, where, you know, some of that kind of empathetic conversation and confrontation could help, because understanding that each generation sort of needs a little bit of a facet of the other, but there's a lot of commonality that could help make workplaces better. But, you know, I think there's kind of that rubber band almost snapback response right now of, well, you know, we hear you, but we, you know, we're not going to implement all these people first policies because it's going to impact our bottom line, not realizing that the amount of time these organizations are spending looking for people, hiring people after people leave as a result of it, are actually impacting their bottom line significantly more. So I'm hopeful for the future, but I think it's also why I wrote the book and why I'm trying to speak out as much as possible, because, you know, the more that we talk about it and demystify it and look at it as a tool rather than an emotional response, I think the more people will get comfortable.
It's a practice, isn't it? It's a deliberate, like a muscle, that like going to the gym. And of course it hurts when you first start exercising it, because, you know, you're not used to it and it's probably very uncomfortable. You've written your book, which is great because there's sort of, there's a toolkit part to it, but is that enough, Neil? How else would you see us being able to equip leaders in organizations? Because I often see, I tick a box, I've been on a training on empathy or on creating psychological safety or my high-performing team or whatever. And that's not derogatory at all, but it's 2 days out of a whole year. So how else do you think that as organizations, we can, I suppose, serve our leaders and equip them to deal with basically the moving environment and to have this different skill, which is empathy?
Absolutely. I think one is individuals involved in the kind of human resource, talent management, talent acquisition process really have an opportunity to shine now. Mm. They have an opportunity to have a seat at the table to help inform these leaders of the impact. And depending on, you know, how resistant maybe a senior leader is, sometimes just bare metrics can really help to shift things. Showing the cost of rehiring someone versus the cost of training someone. That's really instructive to a lot of people because they think, well, you know, what happens if we train them and they leave? Well, if you don't train them and they stay, it has a huge negative impact on your organization. But even if they do leave as a result of you not training them, then you're going to spend more money than you would have spent in replacing the individual. So sometimes it comes down to bare numbers, right? The numbers win out. There are a lot of Business Solver, which is a small organization that releases a magazine. They did a huge study on empathy. They do it every year, and it shows over and over again the cost of organizations that don't adopt a people-first mindset, especially now that the newer generations are really expecting a higher level of empathy. If, you know, the numbers themselves don't pan out, I always challenge people who have a problem with it to think about times in their careers that they have experienced non-empathetic leadership, right? When they've experienced a leader that has been maybe applied a rubric that across an organization that didn't fit everyone or didn't offer flexibility, would you have been more successful in that role? Would you have gotten further in your career if you had been in an environment like that? And more often than not, everyone can pinpoint a situation. And then it's about holding people accountable. As you said, it is a muscle. It hurts at first, and your form is going to be terrible until you start to get it right. And I think it's important to have a space for that conversation, to be able to, you know, talk to, from a peer perspective, each other about making sure that we're not just checking a box, that we're really taking that extra step. But it comes back to that CEO, that president, that executive leader, whoever is at the top has to invite that. They have to make that environment as safe as possible. Otherwise, they really are just going to get kind of homogenized responses to their questions, and you know, they will see their growth stagnate.
And I think, you know, role modeling is proven as to be one of the most powerful and impactful ways of shifting paradigms in an organization, because we all do that. We all look up to see what's happening and to see if top leaders are walking their talk, which is where I really liked the idea of empathetic confrontation and you know, explicitly putting it out there that challenge is fine as long as it's done in a way that's respectful, if I put my words on it. But what's your biggest takeaway, Neil, from researching and writing this book? Because as I was reading, I was thinking, you know, writing a book in itself is quite a feat, isn't it? It's quite a journey. It's quite an experience, I would imagine. So what's your biggest takeaway from both the writing, the discipline of writing that book and sharing your voice, and also what you learned through the research?
Certainly. You know, from writing the book, I learned that routine is incredibly important in situations like this. Mm. My co-author was much more a routine-based person, and I am a little bit more, you know, scattered. And I found that to really meet deadlines, routine was incredibly important. I also found that, you know, I really enjoy these conversations and being able to kind of promote this book, but it is an area where I am uncomfortable simply because self-promotion is a challenge because of imposter syndrome. And so I realized sort of as a result of that, the like additional work that I have to do on myself psychologically, which is kind of a beautiful thing to be writing this book, to sort of speak to a group of people that I think I can kind of improve and help kind of through this journey of really pushing this empathetic leadership, but then also realizing like, oh, I still have a lot of work to do myself. And I think that's kind of core to it, right? Like we're all on dissimilar journeys, but certainly all on paths that are hopefully pointing towards a more enlightened state. And that was one thing I learned from writing this book, is just how impactful it can be when you lend your voice to the conversation.
Absolutely.
You know, I really, and not just for yourself, although that is important, but for the people around you. Suddenly people are much more comfortable having conversations with you. And then from the research standpoint, you know, for me, it was, I always had an idea of what empathetic leadership looked like and what its impact would be. But for me, it was the numbers. It was, okay, we start to apply this and then, all right, we've had a 50% increase in our headcount and a 3x multiplier in our revenue in a couple of years. Our retention at an organization that I worked for, our retention went from, we had a 35 or 40% attrition down to single digits within a 12-month period.
Wow.
And that didn't cost me anything except for time to spend, to listen, to fix problems. You know, a lot of people think, throw money at it. Throw, you know, people need more money and they need better benefits. And honestly, they do. Pay your people more. But but that is not all people need. If you're paying them a really strong livable wage, they have good benefits, and they're still leaving, then the reason is probably situational, organizational, or flexibility based. And those are things that you can learn by engaging and having those conversations. So for me, the return on investment of empathy is incredible. And it was shocking to see some of the numbers, because when I was writing the book, I thought, why isn't everybody doing this? It's so easy. It's just vulnerability. It's just opening yourself up to having those conversations. And that's why they're not doing it, because as you said, it's a muscle that nobody exercises, or not nobody, but you know, people don't exercise naturally.
Well, it's also the fear, isn't it? It's the fear of showing things I don't normally show, seeing who I am a little bit more. And you know, we all know that transformations, particularly this is a statistic around digital transformation, but all transformation is digital these days, but that they fail, you know, due to people-related issues and not necessarily technology or process-related issues. And you talk about that in your book as well, and you talk about the common fears during transformation. Can you walk us through a couple of those fears? Because I think the first step is naming your fear before you can step over it. Whether that's about transformation, imposter syndrome, different types of leadership, or what. I think humans are innately fearful of what they don't know.
Absolutely. Yeah, transformation is incredibly tough. And organizational transformation is terrifying to people because they see organizations do it the wrong way and they see jobs impacted, lives impacted. And it's natural to have that initial fear. It's natural to be fearful of transformation yourself because you don't know what's going to come on the other side of it. And then that starts to manifest, right? It manifests as anger or you know, bad behavior, lack of productivity. I always recommend people who are going into kind of a transformational experience to start by asking themselves some questions around what is like the root cause of their fear? What is, you know, shine a light on it. What is it that you're concerned about? And then once you've identified where you are emotionally and intellectually with the situation, talk to the people that are going to be impacted. Have those conversations, share your own fears and share how you're mediating and remediating them, right? What is my role going to look like after transformation? Well, I don't know, but this is what I am pushing towards. Have those conversations as much as you can. You know, we went through a pretty significant transformation at the company that I work for now, and it required, unfortunately, some layoffs, which are never easy. And typically after layoffs, you see a lot of people leave an organization because they're scared of what's coming next. We had no voluntary terminations after those layoffs because we were honest about what the process looked like, what our motivation was, what the thought process was, and where we made mistakes, we were honest about it. I know that is incredibly vulnerable and tough to do, but if you want to alleviate people's fears, you have to bring them into the light. Fear thrives in darkness. It thrives in quiet. And if no one's addressing them, if no one's talking about it, people will come to the worst possible conclusions. They'll catastrophize, and then it will get worse and it will impact your culture and your morale. So it really is as simple as listen to people and solicit them for their input, and then be as transparent as is reasonable within your organization.
And like you say, it sounds so simple. and it's simple to say, but it's hard to do, isn't it? Particularly if you're, well, I think two things: running to deliver, almost running on empty to deliver, but also standing behind these myths that are implicit in organizations of what a strong leader is. We touched on that at the beginning of the podcast, but I do think that they've done quite a lot of damage in terms of people therefore saying something different. And time is running, but I've got a couple more questions. It brings me to my next question of, what is your most transformative experience, Neil, with using empathy in the workplace? I mean, there are lots of stories in the book, and I would invite all our listeners to go and read them. But, you know, I just want to take the opportunity, the fact that I have you here, to ask you what your most transformative experience is.
It's hard to nail down, but I will say I worked at an organization that was very unhealthy, that had a lot of significant infighting, a lot of morale issues, some really toxic individuals who were creating very hostile work environments. It took some time. It took about a year and a lot of reorganization, a lot of very hard conversations and hard decisions. And employees after would come up to me and say, man, I like coming to work again. And to me, wow, that was everything. I hope that, you know, whatever my legacy is, it's things like that, right? Mm. It's being able to make small micro changes within an organization that impact a person's entire work experience. And that's the power of empathy, and the power of empathetic leadership is you are making substantive changes to people's lives for the better. Work is a necessary evil, right? None of us, if all of us had trust funds, none of us would work if we didn't have to, right? Or maybe I'm just speaking for myself there. But, you know, if we're going to spend a third of our lives at work, let's try to be leaders, and let's try to be future leaders who are making it the best possible place it can be. So for me, it's really about that. I know that's a relatively simple answer that comes with a lot of hard work and tough conversations before it. But for me, the most transformative experiences are ones where employees come up to me afterwards and say, I enjoy being at work again. That to me is the thing that I strive for the most.
Yeah, which, you know, and it's the most simple KPI, isn't it?
It really is.
How many people have come to me and said, I want to come to work again, or I really enjoy coming to work? And it can be as simple as that in terms of what you're measuring. The complexity lies behind how you do it, of course, Neil, as you've just illustrated. What would your final call to action be for our listeners on this topic of, particularly at the higher levels of organization, leveraging more empathetic leadership?
I would say, get out of your own heads. Stop worrying. No, it's true. I mean, because there's a lot of leaders who get so nervous about having those vulnerable conversations. Mm. And I get it. Every time I post something, every time when I wrote the book, I was fearful that it would impact future jobs for me, that someone would look at me and say, wow, he's weak. He's not the leader that this organization needs. And if you are someone who truly wants to make an impact, start small. Start with a person who is on your team, who you trust, and have that open conversation. It is, as you said, and it's a perfect analogy, it's a muscle. So start working it out gently. Don't try to change your entire organization overnight. Don't try to enact massive change. Mm-hmm. Start with an individual that you can impact. And then it's free. Really, it costs nothing.
That's the best
your
thing.
Time. It's the best part. It's free, and you will see results. So that really is my call to action. Get out of your head, put your ego aside, because at the end of the day, you can really start to make, you know, very significant changes. And, you know, it really just takes conversations, and it really just takes engaging with people in a very honest and vulnerable way.
Thank you. I'm going to leave our listeners with that, because I think a lot of us live in our heads 95% of the time. So getting out of our own heads and having more courageous conversations. Neil, thank you so much for coming and sharing your stories, your experience, your book, your research. Where can people find out more about you, your book, and what you do?
Certainly. So the book is available on Amazon and through Barnes & Noble, but you can also get it through theesuite.com. You can find me on Instagram at theanxiousceo1. Okay. I talk a lot about my anxiety and mental health, and then also at medium@neil.frick. And certainly please reach out. I love to have continuing conversations. So hopefully this was helpful for some of your listeners. And thank you, Susie, so much for having me on.
It's been a pleasure. It's been a great conversation. I will put all those links in our show notes so that our listeners can contact you if they need to and if they want to. Thank you. Thanks, Neil.